Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a Wall Street insider who was a former managing director at Goldman Sachs to get a reading on how Wall Streeters are reacting to the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations. Nomi Prince joins us to explain how the demonstrators on the street have little to no effect on those inside the tall buildings, 62% of whom are expecting higher bonuses this year, while much of the rest of working America is being downsized or terminated. Then we'll go to Cairo, Egypt, to find out who is behind the violent assault on Coptic Christian demonstrators that left 25 dead and more than 270 wounded. A former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, Yasmin El Rashidi, joins us to explain what happened and why, as the Copts, who make up over 10% of the Egyptian population, feel more and more helpless and threatened by Islamists and the army, who instead of protecting them from sectarian violence, have mowed them down and run over them with tanks. Then finally, we will hear from Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic, who organized a forum last week in Washington that featured top Obama administration officials Joe Biden, Bill Daley, Valerie Jarrett, and Tim Geithner, etc., along with the likes of Antonin Scalia, Marco Rubio, and Dick Cheney. We'll find out what transpired and what was learned from this conclave of Beltway titans. Joining us now is Nomi Prince, an author, journalist, and senior fellow at the Demos think tank. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. Her new book, a historical novel, is Black Tuesday. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nomi Prince.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And we're talking on a day where we learn that in a recent poll by eFinancialCareers.com found that 62% of those working on Wall Street said they're expecting a bonus that's in line with last year's or higher. And that, I would think, in contrast to what's happening with the rest of working America, would at the very least indicate that they're doing well and the rest of the country's not. Do you think in any way people on Wall Street recognize the difference between what's happening on Wall Street in terms of financial success and what's happening in the rest of America?
You know, if certain people recognize it, and of course there are thousands that work there, but for the most part, and certainly when I work there and what I'm hearing from the inside, what I'm seeing watching it as a civilian, and as someone who supports the protests, I think that they don't really think about what's happening on the outside. There's a real emphasis on, you know, day-to-day business and on, you know, who did what trade and which trade is going to get seen by whose boss and who's going to get how much bonus out of that and so forth. That a lot of what happens inside those walls is very, very immediate and related to how much money can you take out of any particular transaction. So given that, you know, what's happening on the outside is something that doesn't really impact how they go about thinking about those transactions and how much money and how much a bonus they're going to get at the end of the year because of that. Now, of course, there are people with consciences and there are people with less of them, and so this doesn't mean that every single person thinks exactly the same way, but predominantly when you're on the inside, you're concerned about the money you're going to make, how you're going to make, and who's going to know you made it, and that's really what's driving you every day. And so what's going on now is, of course, you know, some people are coming into work, into the offices of Wall Street. You know, they're hearing about the protests. They know they're going on. They're not necessarily living in a tomb. But that said, a lot of the, you know, the walls that sort of keep the bankers, the traders, the salespeople, the executives and the management committees and so forth, apart from what's going on outside, still exist.
So have you any indications of what the attitudes are then to the people that are demonstrating? I mean, how much do they get in their face? How much do they have to sort of cross the picket line, so as to speak?
Well, yeah, for the most part, and you know, if you think about the executives, and this is not new to these this current round of protesting, which, again, it's on the news. It is being made heard, but these people, the main executives, don't exactly take the subways to get into work. You know, they have these like black Lincoln Town cars, they go to side streets, they go in. They're not really having to physically, geographically cross a lot of these lines. Now people who aren't at the top, who don't necessarily have the cars, who sort of lower down the pecking order of these firms, might have to. But the way in which, in New York anyway, geographically, it's been laid out is that many senior people can get to work without having anything, or very little to physically, do in it with the protesters, which I think can change as that number grows, as there are more protesters on the streets, as they spill over into a larger area, of course that changes. But there's always been this way of segmenting oneself as an executive at lots of these firms from anyone on the outside, you know, and whether it's by not taking a subway or not taking, you know, a bus, or you know, living in a very, very large compound in the Hamptons. There's ways that they really keep themselves, you know, physically separate from everyone else. I mean, not just protesters, but, you know, people sort of in general, in their day-to-day going in and out of work sometimes.
Again, I'm speaking with Naomi Prince, author, journalist, a senior fellow at the Demos think tank. She worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the international analytics group at Bear Stearns in London. So then, what would affect these people in the sense that they're doing well and the taxpayer made them whole and the average American now feels that they're getting squeezed and there's the call of the 99% at the 1%, you know, is that going across the country and these people are the 1%? I noticed that just shortly after the 2008 crash, there were some people who showed up at the homes of some of these hedge funds managers in Greenwich and other places like that, and that seemed to be effective. Here in Los Angeles, we had a weekend or so ago in Bel Air, a group of protesters showed up at the home of the head of One West Bank, who had evicted a family because they were 1 month late on their mortgage payment. So do you think that is a more effective way, or do you think that these people, do they have a sense that they've gotten off incredibly well? None of them have gone to jail. A lot of these protesters have gone to jail.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that protesters are being hauled off for protesting, for exercising their democratic voice, their right to free speech and everything else, while a lot of the individuals who were involved in very fraudulent activities that exploited and extracted and stole from the rest of the country in many ways and in different ways is really appalling. And I do think that, you know, showing up in front of homes of some of the executives who really make the decisions, who really are the ones who decide which types of transactions are going to get done, how they're going to get done, who hand wave any potential red flags that might even, you know, look like they're negative for people from the transactions that they do. I think that's an effective way of getting in their faces. Definitely, it's a more physical way of getting in their faces. In terms of them, you know, someone who, you know, Lloyd Blankfein or someone who runs Goldman Sachs or something like that, actually being afraid, I think in terms of how his bonus could be impacted, how the shares of the firm could be impacted, which also impacts his bonuses and the bonuses of other people in management, I think there still remains a long road to hoe. And I think that what's going on now is encouraging that more people of different walks of life are banding together, and they have similar grievances, and also they come for different reasons to band together, and I think that's positive, but I think it needs to be a lot bigger because it needs to change the way in which Wall Street does business, and that can only really be done from a regulatory or a legislative perspective, and we have a long way to go with that, because in the wake of the crisis of 2008, which we're still living in the aftermath of, there's been very little done in Washington to rectify the situation, to, you know, help people stay in their homes, to reduce the foreclosure claims, to enforce banks using the money and the subsidies they receive from the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department to help people on the ground. None of that's really been done. So there's a lot of work to have happen. But I think that if this movement becomes larger in number, it's another way of exercising that democratic voice, which voting hasn't necessarily done yet.
Well, I suppose just in...
I shouldn't even say necessarily. There's no qualifier. It hasn't done yet.
Well, just in closing, though, Naomi Prince, what about at least getting them to pay more taxes? Will that get their attention?
I think that would get their attention. And, again, that's another demand that needs to be stipulated. But they have a lot of money behind their lobbying and their efforts to not be taxed or to have their stuff offshore and to not be taxed in other manners. So again, a lot of things can be done. And a lot of things could actually impact them, but they need to happen.
I see. So just in closing again, though, Naomi Prince, do you think that at the end of the day, this movement is going to affect these people? They may have disdain for them now, and the media, like Fox, have done everything they can to dismiss it. But it's possible that the 99% of this country might join that movement.
I think the effect of the movement will have to do with it growing and with it encouraging other people to join for their various different reasons, and then knowing it's okay regardless of how the media is portraying it as some fringe group of people. It isn't. There are real ways in which many millions of people in this country have been impacted by bad practices and by bad businesses and by poor structure in the banking system, and there's a definite connect to that. And I think that the more attention is drawn to the fact that the impact of those practices and that structure is so negative on all of us, the more we can work together to force some sort of a actual lasting change, which to date has not been what we've received from Washington.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Naomi Prince.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Naomi Prince, author, journalist, and senior fellow at the Demos Think Tank. Her books include Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, and It Takes a Pillage, Behind the Bonuses, Bailouts, and Backroom Deals from Washington to Wall Street. Her new book is a historical novel, Black Tuesday. Before becoming an author and journalist, she worked on Wall Street as a managing director at Goldman Sachs and ran the International Analytics Group at Bear Stearns in London. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back and go to Cairo, Egypt.
Victims and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred more often, just those with hate for us. 'Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Yasmin El-Rashidi, who is the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She joins us from Cairo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian.
And tell me about what happened on Sunday night with 24 Coptic Christians killed, more than 270 wounded, according to the Egyptian health ministry, and pretty much the blame is being laid at the feet of the head of the military council, Field Marshal Hussein Tantawi, who's in charge of, basically in charge of Egypt.
Yes, Ian. Well, I mean, to start with, I think that the figure of 24, they're not all Copts, which I think this needs to be clarified. And what happened is some days ago, there was a church that had been bombed in burned in Aswan in Upper Egypt, and the Copts had organized a marching protest, sort of calling for protection. And that started yesterday afternoon and marched through downtown and was approaching the television building when it was attacked by thugs. And it was at that point that suddenly the situation exploded, escalated, and turned into the chaos that, you know, I'm sure you've been seeing on TV. And it was a combination of factors. You know, I think it was instigated by thugs. who infiltrated and penetrated that protest. The army then began shooting in the air to try and disperse and warn people. And then it seemed that sort of panic very quickly escalated. Armored vehicles driven by obviously soldiers began sort of zooming up and down the streets, kind of pushing through protesters, trampling over some, killing them. There was gunfire. Some of it was from the army. Some of it, I believe, was from outside thugs. And then sort of it very quickly spiraled. The cars were set on fire. People began beating one another. It turned into a really, really ugly incident, instigated by thugs, escalated by the army, and then further escalated by, I think, mobs. You know, it was very much that mob mentality from what I saw.
And Yasmin El-Rashidi, I understand also that state television, their anchors, urged honorable citizens to head down and help the soldiers defend themselves. So that's further instigation, it would seem.
The state TV played a critical and criminal role last night. They said that Coptic protesters with guns had shot at their soldiers, and indeed they called on people to go down and protect their soldiers from those Coptic protesters, armed Coptic protesters. And so, that obviously didn't help. And, you know, by the end of the evening, Ian, there were young men who were seeking out the Copts and saying that they would kill any cops that they could get their hands on. And I watched as dozens of young cops, men and women, were beaten. They were brutally assaulted by these mobs. And at one point, I saw a young man and a young woman trying to come out of the protest and go home. They were identified as cops, and a group of about 15 young men with sticks went in on them, beat them up, and one of them emerged with blood all over his hands, waving his hands in the air, boasting the fact that he had Coptic blood on his hands. So it was, I do question if that same young man would have done that the day before or even before that. You know, we don't have that culture of this kind of violence between Copts and Muslims. There have been incidents, but not to that level. We've never seen that kind of brutality. I think it was partly state TV. I think it was partly this mob mentality. There's a combination of factors.
Well, Yasmin El-Rashidi, again, author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt, frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books. She's joining us from Cairo. We're talking about the demonstrations in Cairo on Sunday night that turned violent. And they, of course, were organized to protest the recent burning of a church by the Salafists, I take it. And one of the complaints that the cops have is the lackadaisical response of the ruling military junta to these fairly frequent anti-Christian attacks. And, of course, the Copts are 10% of the population of Egypt, but they don't seem to have a lot of political representation. Is that correct?
They don't. I mean, it's true. They are a minority. They're about 10 to 15% of the population of 82 million. There have been prominent Copts over the years who've had important positions in government, but for the most part, they are extremely underrepresented, and that's, sort of across the spectrums of government and business. And they have, they've actively asked for support over the months, especially since Mubarak stepped down, and they haven't really got it. And I think the military council has made promises that it hasn't delivered on. The cabinet has made promises that it hasn't delivered on demands that they've put forward. Yesterday, it's true, there are huge questions as to why the army did not try to control the situation in a different way. I have information from a very informed source that what happened with those armored vehicles running up and sort of zooming up and down the streets and, stampeding, killing these protesters, they hadn't been given instructions to do so. The soldiers didn't know how to react. They hadn't been given instructions, and it sounded like it was panic. However, why didn't the army try to contain the situation? You know, why didn't it try and disperse some of the people who kept coming in? There were clearly thugs coming in as the hours unfolded into the night. And then again today, I went downtown, and there was the gathering of Muslims chanting Islamia, Islamia, which means an Islamic State, we want an Islamic State. Why did the army allow those to gather again today? So there are very huge questions about why the army isn't containing things. You know, we understand that they must be capable. We understand that it's difficult to contain a mob, but they must have techniques. And it's not the first time that this has escalated. A few weeks ago, it was the Israeli embassy. It was a very similar kind of energy, a similar kind of escalation. And again, the army allowed it to unfold into what it did.
So what are we to surmise from this, Yasmin El-Rashidi, where you have thugs provoking the kind of violence that the military is responsible for, and apparently you're suggesting there's a lack of discipline there, but there seems to be a motive on the part of some of the political players, whether it's opportunism or not. Now, what's interesting is that the Muslim Brotherhood's SML Arian condemned the violence. So even though what provoked these demonstrations were burnings of churches by ultra-conservative Muslims, then you have the element of the thugs. So who's orchestrating the thugs? Given the response of the Muslim Brotherhood, what do you make of that?
I think, Ian, that the thugs are in some way linked to the former regime, not specifically paid by, you know, former officials, but loyalists to that regime. The former state security apparatus was known to include tens of thousands of thugs, and they are still out in the country, and I think their loyalties still lie with that regime. And so when a protest of 10,000 or more takes to the streets, you know, chanting, I think the attack it's an opportunity to, and it's a statement against the revolution and against the revolutionaries. And it is the opportunity to create the kind of disorder and chaos that I believe the former regime, the corrupt elements of the former regime are delighted to witness. You know, let's not forget that Mubarak warned that if he left, there would be chaos. And this is the chaos that we are seeing. The Muslim Brotherhood, I don't believe, has any involvement in such things. They're much too savvy for this. But in a sense, they are manipulating a situation by calling for quicker elections and using that as, you know, using this to say that the solution is elections. And they are in a very strong position. They are the most organized political party and faction. They are confident that they're going to win a sizable chunk or majority of the parliamentary seats. And for them, this all sort of aids their cause. As everyone else is fighting in the streets and arguing, they are still very, very actively preparing for elections, campaigning, and lobbying support.
So the extent to which then the thugs, who are the leftovers from the Mubarak regime, are trying to provoke trouble to keep the old guard in power in the form of the military junta, who are pretty much the vestiges of Mubarak, although they promised to step out of the way. They're certainly taking their time. So the Muslim Brotherhood, does it recognize the cynicism of the military regime, or is it just focused on it winning the next election?
I think the Muslim Brotherhood, they're playing a very, very careful game in that they are making sure that they don't ruffle the feathers of the military, because they have an understanding that they could be crushed as they were under the former regime. So they're walking a very, very fine and careful line, you know, sort of showing enough support with the military when necessary, being pretty consistent in their statement of what they hope to achieve and moving forward to elections, they're being very careful about which protests they go down and join and which they boycott. And I think that's where you really see where the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood lies.
Well, clearly then, Yasmin El-Rashidi, does that mean that the liberals who in many ways started the revolution and the Copts are going to be shut out? The Brotherhood is keeping its relationships with the military in order to end up with more power, and that the military obviously don't support the Copts, and they certainly don't support the liberals. So does that mean that the next government, in effect, after these elections, will be somehow some combination of conservative military elements and Muslim Brotherhood?
I think there'll be a large chunk of Islamists, not just Muslim Brotherhood, but Islamist representation. I think there will be then a real fragmentation, you know, between different forces. I think that former regime elements will definitely have a chunk of the peace. And then I think what will happen is there will be enough of a fragmented parliament that will never in many ways reach a solution on anything. I think that what we're seeing right now in the political landscape is a discourse that's not reaching any conclusions or any answers. Nobody's able to agree because nobody is willing to compromise. And I think that we're going to see that duplicated in the parliament to come. And I think that's where the military gains its control. By having a parliament that in many ways never reaches conclusions and can't really come to unanimous votes on things, I think will then be controlling the country in another way.
So does if the liberal bloc were more cohesive, what kind of numbers do you think they can deliver? I mean, you know, like all people on the left, they tend to be fragmented, whereas people on the right, and particularly religious people tend to be in lockstep. Is that a factor here?
I feel that, you know, in 2005 we had a parliament that was largely National Democratic Party, which was the ruling party. Then there was a huge chunk of Muslim Brothers. They had 88 seats. And then there were liberals, different kinds of factions of liberals, but again, a minority. I think what we're going to see this time is similar percentage divisions, but the majority will be the Islamists. I think that, again, the former ruling regime elements and the liberals will take, you know, again, two chunks. The liberals, they could take between 30-35%, but I don't think it would be a unified bloc. I think there would be a lot of division between them.
So just in closing then, Yasmin El-Rashidi, what are the fate of the 10% or 10+% of Egyptians who are Coptic Christians? Clearly, the specter of what happened in Iraq looms large, in as much as the Iraqi Christians have all but left that country. You know, ironically, of course, the Christians in Syria are supporting the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad because they're afraid of a Sunni Muslim majority. Is there any? I mean, where are they going to go? What kind of? They must be feeling paranoid after what happened on Sunday night.
Absolutely, Ian. Personally, I was petrified being out in the street, and I was made to feel extremely uncomfortable because I don't cover my hair. So the assumption was that I was a cop. And today again, I attended mass at the cathedral where the cops were, and everyone was uncomfortable. There was a sense of, you know, this faith could be attacked at any moment. I think, you know, the faith of the cops, I think a lot of them will choose, if they're able, to leave the country. You know, the wealthy ones, I think many of them have already left. Those who can immigrate and seek asylum will. I think there will be more incidents of violence, perhaps not as large as what we witnessed last night, but definitely scattered incidents of violence. But the one thing that, you know, I think is coming out of this is the liberal Muslims are outraged too. A couple of hours ago, I was with a young Islamist, a Muslim brother member, and he was in tears. He said, you know, I cannot believe the slaughterhouse that this has become. I cannot believe that human lives are being lost in this way, that they're being butchered. And so the Muslim community, I think, will come together and try and protect the Copts and try and stand with them in solidarity. Is this enough? No. You know, will it get worse? I think that we are moving towards a more fragmented and definitely a more conservative Egypt. And I don't really think that, there is a solution right now. I feel there's such a state of disorder and such a lack of control that it will take a really long time for things to stabilize again.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Yasmin El-Rashidi.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Yasmin El-Rashidi, who's the author of the e-book, The Battle for Egypt. She's a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books and is a former Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She joined us from Cairo. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a very important conference that took place in Washington last week involving a lot of White House insiders and former heavy hitters inside the Beltway. روحي فداك واسمي شهيدك دمي بيجري في دمي وريدك صوتي الحر يا مصر نشيدك انا انفاسك انا تنهيدك انا نبضك نبض الجماهير صوتك في ميدان التحرير امل الثوره والتغيير هرمك نيلك حلمي Idiot wind blowing in through the front door. Idiot wind blowing in from the back. Idiot wind blowing in from every crevice, every crack. Anybody wanna tell it like it is to each other? Like you would to a sister or a brother. Cosmopolitan's time. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Steve Clemens, who is a Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live. He is senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously he served as executive director of the Japan-America Society of Southern California and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Clemens.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And you're in the Gulf as we speak, but last week you organized, along with others, I guess it was the Atlantic, along with the Aspen Institute, a fairly substantial gathering of some of Washington's heavy hitters and insiders. And the headlines that came out of it were largely Tim Geithner expressing dismay that Wall Street had abandoned Barack Obama in terms of money for 2012. But surely a lot more took place. You had Marco Rubio, Valerie Jarrett, who's apparently the ultimate White House insider, Robert Rubin, Antonin Scalia, the Supreme Court Justice, Pervez Musharraf, Joe Biden, the Vice President, Henry Kissinger, and you conducted a panel with Dick and Liz Cheney. So let's just start with the Geithner headlines.
Well, I thank you for mentioning the forum. I mean, it was a very, very diverse forum. And as you know, it's not often that you see the political diversity of such major, you know, heavy hitters, people that were, you know, in the deep inside, like Valerie Jarrett and Bill Daley from the White House, but then also having, you know, Dick Cheney and others. It's a very different kind of forum. There were a lot of chefs in this kitchen that helped cook this up. But in my view, what Tim Geithner was trying to say is that Barack Obama, in his estimation, saved the financial sector, saved the large banks and financial institutions from certain collapse, and that they've expressed very little remorse about that. Joe Biden really lashed into Bank of America for this $5 per month debit fee charge that they're planning to charge this next year, and said, you know, and Joe Biden was very emphatic, said the American people bailed out, taxpayers bailed out Bank of America, and now Bank of America is doing this. And it raised something, you know, about the relationship between government and the private sector that I wrote about a long time ago on the Washington Note, my blog, where I had said that I think a lot of legislators and politicians are going to presume that the interests of these companies are automatically going to converge and align with government interests. And we're just not designed that way. And so to some degree, while I understand where Geithner is coming from, but I mean, apparently he expected a quid pro quo from Obama, which is a bit disconcerting. But that they just sort of believed, in my view, kind of naively, that the American corporate sector would come around and support them. And it raises other fundamental questions about, you know, as I've thought, we bailed out the wrong players. You know, we should have been investing in infrastructure and working on jobs much, much earlier than we had, because many of us never thought that the financial sector would play nicely with the Obama administration. But what was the screaming need at the time was putting Americans back to work and stopping as best we could this rapid foreclosure rate that was hollowing out neighborhoods and putting families out on the street. So I think that, you know, to some degree, you know, while Geithner and you know, even Vice President Biden made the comments they did, and I understand it, I still think it was naive and they were in the wrong foot on the approach on the economy.
But Steve Clemens, the book by Ron Suskind, which I don't think is particularly helpful in terms of the White House's reelection, because the most damaging thing, apart from the fact that Wall Street money is probably going to go to Mitt Romney, assuming he gets the nomination, the implication in that is that Obama is not in control, that he's not up to the job. And one of the revelations in that book, of course, was that, according to Suskind, Geithner was insubordinate to the president. The president wanted to shut down Citibank, and Geithner sort of walked it back, as they say in Washington parlance. Did any of those questions come up?
Well, they came up, you know, I wasn't always in the room, but they came up most directly with Valerie Jarrett, who was asked more by Ron Brownstein, much more directly about how women were treated in the White House and what the general tempo was inside the fights and skirmishes that were going on. And I also think Melody Barnes, the president's domestic policy advisor, was asked a very direct question about that as well. So I think that those particular interviewers decided to take the gender question route with the White House, as opposed to the larger issues about who was implementing and not implementing the president's plan. I think these questions about the ferocity of the fights around the White House are interesting. But if Tim Geithner was insubordinate, if they had made decisions to shut down Citibank and go a certain way, and then fundamentally there was an insurrection against the president, that's very important, very interesting to know. Just because it was, of course, you know, Geithner and others who were very involved with letting Lehman Brothers go, and they, you know, got their feet burned pretty badly, and I think then they decided they couldn't let any of these other larger institutions go and fall by the wayside.
Again, I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic and editor-in-chief of Atlantic Live, and he organized, along with the Aspen Institute, a forum that took place, the third annual Washington Ideas Forum that took place last week and featured a number of senior White House officials, along with a lot of important political players, world leaders, and Dick and Liz Cheney, who Steve Clemens interviewed, which obviously I want to talk about. But but just staying with your remark, Steve, about the White House women, Melody Barnes and Valerie Jarrett, what is the gender issue there? Is it that the men don't obey the president and the women do? I didn't quite...
Well, no, in the Suskind book, it goes into some length about how it is a male-oriented place and that women are disadvantaged from the start and in working with their male counterparts, that it's a house full of jocks, according to Ron Suskind. And so it was raising a lot of these issues about the women that were in the inner circle, that very few women were in the inner circle, and if they were, they were looked down upon and essentially frequently, you know, from a policy perspective in debate, that some felt beaten up in the process. And, you know, I don't know whether that would be accurate or inaccurate. I know Ron captured some of this in his book, and it has stirred up quite a lot of emotional anger here in Washington among some people. There are some people that have been more on the record than others. Anne-Marie Slaughter, who is director of policy planning at the State Department, has been one of the few to be more public about her concerns about this seeming mistreatment of women in the White House. So that was another part of the juicy element of the Susskind book that's been getting some attention.
I see. Well, back to the forum itself. What did the Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia talk about? Because obviously,
oh, I'm going to disappoint you here, because in that one I was out basically tending other things, you know. And I should tell everybody that all of these videos of the entire forum, and it does range from people like Antonin Scalia to Joe Biden to Tim Geithner to Howard Schultz of Starbucks, to Bill Daley of the White House, Pervez Musharraf, the former president of Pakistan, my discussion with Henry Kissinger, all of these are videotaped and at the Atlantic.com website if they just Google Ideas Forum. But on Scalia, I had met him 2 weeks before, and Scalia was quite taken with things that I was surprised, because I was predisposed, as you know, my politics, not to be, you know, someone that would be in a groove with him. But I found his knowledge. I mean, there were two real surprises, because I did see just a snippet of what Scalia put on the table. And I know this will be disappointing to the readers, because it has nothing to do with substance. But in style and the quickness on their feet, I was somewhat blown away by Senator Marco Rubio and in my previous discussion with Antonin Scalia. And there's a lot of talk about Rubio about potentially being the vice presidential selectee on a GOP ticket. In fact, when we did a survey of politicos on the stage, of people who kind of write about these issues a lot, almost all of them speculated that Marco Rubio was the front runner. But I have to tell you, listening to him, and he and I do not share the same worldview, he will outshine any of the possible front runners on the ticket. He is a very, very smart, extremely well-informed guy who I think can be lethal in a debate. And, you know, to some degree, he will be – I can't imagine that he won't outshine and be faster on his feet in a conservative political field than the person who actually gets selected to be president on the GOP ticket.
Well, Steve Clements, wouldn't they be putting him on the ticket to do damage control, since the Republican Party in these presidential forums have essentially trashed, at least the audience members and a lot of the candidates have done a lot of Latino bashing? And even
I think Latino bashing, I think it's Florida, and I think it's someone who ostensibly bridges the Tea Party and mainstream GOP candidates, and there aren't that many of them, and so Rubio is likely to be one of those. But I was, you know, very, very impressed with his grasp of detail and his ability to be fast on his feet and talk about it, and it makes me think, as someone who's more in the progressive camp, that he is going to be a real challenge for Democrats in whatever package he eventually comes in.
Well, what did Henry Kissinger have to say to you?
Well, Kissinger was interesting. We mainly focused on questions regarding China. I asked him to talk with us whether he had shifted. One of the areas that I've always been interested in from my days working with Chalmers Johnson was the split between those people who could look at the economic dimensions of national interest and those who tended to look at security and the size of armies and missiles and whatnot. And you know, Kissingerian realism was born in the days before Japan and China became large economic players. And when I read his book on China, he began talking about things that were very unlike a realist. He talked about needing to develop a framework of strategic trust with China. This is a very un-Kissingerian notion, and he defended himself somewhat. So it was a more of a theoretical discussion with Kissinger. We didn't get into, you know, these were 20-minute segments. I would have loved to have gotten into, you know, Allende bombing Cambodia. How does he feel about, you know, what were the worst and best days that he had with Nixon and Ford? There were people that I had met recently who had worked for him and talked about what a complicated boss he was. So I hope they'd get more into the personal, but we primarily discussed China. And I think discussing China is important today. I mean, if you read Mitt Romney's speech the other day, I just wrote about it. I thought it was a depressingly conventional speech, but he didn't really lay out a strategic vision on any front at all, and particularly on China. He starts off talking, you know, about, issues abroad and Israel and the Middle East and fundamentalism, but, you know, kind of skips over the big issues. And so with Kissinger, I was trying to get into a broader discussion about America's strategic interests and this very big moment of uncertainty and doubt about America's resolve and ability to get things done in the world, while China quietly, well, less and less quietly, rises and ascends and is really capturing more and more of the global spotlight.
So, Steve Clements, do you know who's advising Mitt Romney on foreign policy? Because much of what he says is alarmingly ignorant, to be frank.
By the way,
he just at the Citadel the other day, he called for more defense spending. I don't think anybody on the planet thinks that we need to spend more on defense given the economic conditions that we're in.
I mean, he said that, you know, he made a remarkable statement. He said, first, we need to revive the American economy. And then right after, he said, the first thing I'll do in the office is to reverse these dangerous Obama defense cuts. And I'm like going, do you have any sense of what's going on in the U.S. economy, and do you know what we're spending on defense? Here's a data point for your listeners, which is quite interesting. In 1985, the United States was the economy represented about one-third or 33% of the world's GDP, and we spent about one-third of what the world spends on defense. Today, the United States economy represents about 21% of the world's GDP, and we spend over half of what the world spends on defense. And so the idea that you are going to exacerbate and create a larger divide is remarkable. It was a remarkable speech. I do know quite a number of his advisors. In fact, he just announced them this week. And it's a mixed pool of people. And frankly, you know, there are a lot of people I was pleased not to see on there, like Elliot Abrams and Max Boot. These are some of the leading neoconservative personalities. Bill Kristol was not on the list. And Frank Gaffney was another kind of super hawk that is often on these advisory lists. And none of these more flamboyant personalities were, but the more, I mean, I know this will sound crazy, the more thoughtful and cautious and careful and principled neoconservatives and some realists comprised the Romney advisory team. And there are a number of smart people that I think would be ashamed to have drafted this speech that he gave. So I think it was a very, very poor speech that kept calling for Obama to be more strategically coherent, but there was nothing coherent about Romney's speech at all, and nothing that offered a kind of sense of broader strategy. It was a laundry list of items that was just sort of hung together in this loose and frankly strange way. He also talked about, you know, pumping up, putting more Navy ships in the Pacific essentially doubling down on terrorism. So is it, you know, somewhat antiquated speech?
Well, let's get to I don't know if it's a juicy part, but it's the part that most puzzles me, Steve Clements.
Well, it's the more awkward part.
Well, given that, here you are, you know, the co-founder of the Japan Policy Research Institute with
right.
Chalmers Johnson, and pretty much a protege, I guess is a way to put it,
yeah.
Of Chalmers. And here you are sitting down with Dick and Liz Cheney. So tell me about.
Well, you know, there is a I was expecting this, and I'm so pleased you and I are the first ones to really talk about this. When you put on something like this, and now I have a senior editorial position at the Atlantic, and I should also add that while JPRI, which I did found with Chalmers, and which I do still serve on the board, the actual director, I need to get this in my bio, is actually up at University of San Francisco now, a very nice person named Chiho Sawada. But in the process of doing this with Dick and Liz Cheney, the idea was to bring someone on, do it as an experiment, to have them talk about this father-daughter issue of writing a book together. She was the CEO of the book. That's what he called her. And anyone familiar with my writing would know that I've written some of the most scathing criticisms of Cheney, the Cheney White House, and the Cheney-David Addington partnership. David Addington was his national security advisor when Scooter Libby was his chief of staff. And then when Scooter went to jail and resigned, David Addington was elevated to chief of staff. And it is that combination that led, in my view, to some of the biggest distortions and warping of American law and American norms and values. And so it is a huge thing for me to even be on stage with someone like that. But in a role that is, you know, editorially responsible, you want to keep an open mind to various kinds of things. In the best of all circumstances, you would have an ability to come in and really rip through materials. And I didn't have that opportunity. I had an opportunity to ask Cheney what his regrets were. He made this interesting comment that politicians just want to be loved. This is the thing that got the most coverage. And I asked him, did he feel loved? I got to ask him whether, if you took politics out of it and partisanship out of it, what did he have to say or what could he reflect on national security decision-making process? Because, and I said that there was the impression that many had that he and Donald Rumsfeld took hold of that decision-making process and sort of warped it their direction in their own belief that nobody else was performing up to par. And so it was a fairly, on one level, you know, this was not going to give people who despise and have a very deep emotional objection to Cheney, this is not going to check off their boxes for them. But on the other hand, in the Atlantic, in the kind of conferences that are not partisan, that are not tilted, where you are bringing consequential voices together, this was a bit of an experiment. And it was, you know, to be candid, it was awkward for me because I've, you know, when Liz Cheney said, I bet there are a lot of people in this audience who've written some very critical things of my father, but I raised my hand on the stage, which got a round of applause. But it was a short thing. It was an odd experiment because you're trying to do several things at once. I'm trying to show, at least I've got my mind open to hear what these guys have to say. At the same time, I think it doesn't excuse any of the warping and distortions of what I think are fundamental codes of conduct and basic core values of the United States that I think got twisted very much out of shape after 9/11, and which I think this country's fall really began to become quite precipitous. And when I asked Cheney if he had any regrets, he said, no, I think we basically got it right. So it's a snapshot of something, but it's certainly not a profile of a journalist ripping into someone, because it wasn't something set up that way. So I did what I could,
right.
But it certainly was one of the more interesting and awkward experiences, because I think they had to be magnanimous to be on that stage with me, and I had to be magnanimous to be on that stage with them.
Just in closing, Steve, that when you say when Cheney said we got it right, what about that relationship with Bush, the extent to which there's lots of talk of him usurping
power
and doing end runs around him? I mean, and there doesn't seem to be much love lost between the two of them now. One gets the impression that George W. Bush, on reflection, looking back at his presidency, maybe thinks that Cheney captured
it. Very interesting question. You know, if anyone reads this excellent book by Bart Gellman, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Cheney White House,
the angle.
In his book called The Cheney Vice Presidency, Chapter 8 starts with an exchange between myself and Dick Cheney that was made public by the New York Times, where I had asked Cheney if he could set the context for the decision that the White House was going to ask to delist North Korea from the state sponsors of terror list. And Cheney just stopped and he just began glaring at me. And he says, well, I'm not going to announce this decision. And he walked off the stage. That was the time that Dick Cheney had been cut out of the loop. I didn't know that. And I didn't know until Bart did his reporting later to find out. And he had this great line in the book, because Dick Cheney's Secret Service name was called The Angler. And he said the angler had been angled, that Cheney had been outfoxed and outmaneuvered by others in the White House. And this was apparently a very, very bitter thing for him to do. So when Liz Cheney actually asked her father on stage, when I was sitting up with her, asked him, who was your favorite president, Cheney kind of chuckled and laughed, and he says, well, I'm not going to answer that. But you could tell by his demeanor and body posture that it was not George W. Bush, and it was much more likely Gerald Ford for a lot of reasons. Gerald Ford, when he was chief of staff, and he conveyed admiration and respect for Ford at various times during his interview, but clearly there's something going on between George W. Bush and Cheney that's fairly deep.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Steve Clemens.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Clemens, who's the Washington Editor-at-Large for The Atlantic and Editor-in-Chief of Atlantic Live. He's also a senior fellow and founder of the American Security Program at the New America Foundation, and previously served as Executive Director of the Japan-American Society of Southern California, and co-founded with Chalmers Johnson the Japan Policy Research Institute, of which he is still director. He also blogs at the Washington Note. Thank you again, Steve.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. So what do we learn from Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking with a Wall Street insider who used to work for Goldman Sachs, Naomi Prince, And I asked her about what are these people inside these tall towers on Wall Street think of all those people on the streets below. They've been rewarded for their failures and almost taking the world economy down. They've been made whole. And here they are, 62% of them are expecting higher bonuses this year, while the people downstairs who are being arrested, while these crooks inside aren't getting arrested, they're out of work, being downsized or terminated. And she said, not surprisingly, they have absolutely no shame. She thinks that the demonstrators ought to go to the homes of these top 1%ers in their mansions in Greenwich and other places, and truly shame them, because that's the only way that you'll ever get through to these people. And, frankly, I hope that happens. And then we went to Cairo, Egypt, to talk to Yasmin El Rashidi, who used to be a correspondent, Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. She also writes for the New York Review of Books, to talk about what happened there on Sunday night, where 25 Christian cops mostly were killed, along with 270 wounded, by the military, who were mowing them down and running them over with tanks. And of course, the military were the heroes of Tahrir Square. But they're clearly taking sides. She said the whole thing was instigated by thugs working for Mubarak, and apparently the old regime hired thousands of thugs to keep the country in line. And these people are basically remnants of the old regime. The Muslim Brotherhood have sided with the demonstrators, although they're playing it fairly coy. They just basically want to win the next election, and they, if anything, they have a kind of tacit arrangement with the military. The people who are going to get screwed are the 10% of the population who are Coptic Christians. They have no political representation. And the liberals, the ones who actually started the revolution, they're eventually going to end up with very little of a slice of the pie. That was pretty much her analysis. Then finally, we spoke with Steve Clemens, the Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic. He organized a conference last week in Washington that had a lot of the top administration officials like Joe Biden, Bill Daley, Valerie Jarrett, Tim Geithner, etc., along with Scalia and Senator Marco Rubio and Dick Cheney, quite an interesting mix of people there. To ask him about Geithner's reactions to the book by Ron Susskind that said that Geithner was basically insubordinate. He talked a little bit about that and talked about Dick Cheney, who, from his conversations with Cheney, there's no question that there is a big falling out between Cheney and Bush, which we'll obviously try and talk about another time.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can podcast and also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.